Hello and welcome to Roll With The Punches. This is episode number 213 and I am your host, Tiffany Cook. My guest today is Jenny Valentish. She is fabulous and she is joining me to talk about a few of my favourite things. All things punching people in the face, all in the name of sport, of course. Recently, she released a book, Everything Harder Than Everyone Else, where she talks about and talks to some of the craziest, toughest, and most unique humans, picking apart what is behind this innate drive to succeed at such a high level. Now, if you are not under the banner of one of the toughest humans on earth, that's okay. You can just grab out your phone, head into the App Store and download the app Safi. That's S-A-F-I-E. Safi is your personal bodyguard, like having a bodyguard in your pocket. Whether you're traveling and you want to let your family know that you've arrived safe, or you're at home alone or anywhere and you're feeling threatened, you can hit the panic button, alert your emergency contacts immediately, and Safi will record audio, activate GPS and take photos. Now, they also added a fabulous new function recently. It's the I'm not okay button. And we all know how hard it can be to make that call, to reach out, to say the words, hey, I'm not doing too good. So now, Safi allows you to do that at the touch of a button. You can just hit the I'm not okay button and it'll send a friendly message to your contacts to let them know that you probably need them to reach out. So check it out, guys. It is fantastic. You can find out more information at www.safi.com.au. Ross, Matt and the team, they are fabulous. Go and check it out today. Jenny Valentish, welcome to Roll With The Punches.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
Fair to say, I think we're going to have a pretty good chat today because I think we have very similar curiosities around our very similar interests.
I reckon, yeah. And I just love talking about this stuff. Like, it's so much fun.
Me too. I was listening again this morning to a little bit of an audio that you'd done with somebody else. And I was like, oh, come on, 10 o'clock. I can't wait to speak to Jenny.
Brilliant.
So tell us a little bit about you. Who's Jenny? Tell my audience, who are we listening to today? What do you do?
Sure. My name's Jenny Valentish and I am coming to you from Castlemaine in country Victoria. But I'm English, as you can probably tell from the accent. So I moved to Australia in 2006 and I'm a journalist. And I write for people like the ABC and the Guardian and the Age and the Monthly and all that stuff. Mm. But I'm really into writing nonfiction books as well. So I'm starting work on my fifth book now, but the most recent one was Everything Harder Than Everyone Else, Why Some of Us Push Our Bodies to Extremes. Oof. And it's so much fun. I just got to meet the most interesting out there outliers, people who do crazy sports or just push their bodies in other ways and just, you know, really pumped them for information.
Yeah.
What a privilege. What is this job? I mean, you know, being a podcaster, what a privilege.
It is so, and doesn't from start to finish, and I'm about to ask you a direct question about that, doesn't it change the world you live in? You open up your mind to stuff you never understood before and then a year later, you're a completely different person that sees the world. Yep. I've said it 1,000 times this week, I reckon. I keep saying, sometimes I just want to zip back in time to 12 to 18 months ago and feel what the world was like to me then and how I understood it, because I know how much it's changed after the conversations I've had. Tell me the snapshot of what did you know going into this that you wanted to bring out, and then also what came out the other side that just blew your mind? Like, how far beyond what you thought you were going to get out of this did you get? Listen to me with the inability to form questions well. You might need to train me on that.
God, when I listen back to myself interviewing people, I'm like, how did they gauge what I was trying to say?
It's
almost easier being the one answering the question. So I went into this book. The book before was really difficult to write. So it was like an addiction memoir called Women of Substances. And I used myself as the case study. And it was looking at, it's a very gendered look at addiction. Like, what are the reasons that women in particular might fall into addictive patterns of behavior? Mm. Once they're in that zone, what does it look like for them? How does it differ to the experience of men? Like, you can imagine it can be a lot more hairy in some ways, not literally hairy. and then what are the kind of treatment options open to women? But anyway, in the midst of all that, I was looking at endurance and how, for me, when I was younger, like, taking drugs was almost like an Olympic sport. You know, I was really trying to push my body to extremes with this bloody-minded kind of fascination. It served other purposes too, like soothing trauma and stuff like that. But there was this element of how far can I push this meat machine? And I recognize that in other people too. And I was thinking about how we can often use things like drugs or eating disorders or self-harm as a way of controlling our body, mm-hmm. you know, making mm-hmm. it work for you, and maybe regaining control over it if you haven't felt much control over it when you were younger, that kind of thing. So I thought, I'm not quite done with that topic. I reckon there's more there. It was such a small part of Women of Substances. It was only one chapter. Mm. But I thought, you know, I know, for instance, that some people, when they quit drugs, throw themselves into sport.
Yeah.
And it becomes a different way of, like, self-flagellation and pushing the body and going one harder than everyone else, like having that sense of pride of, I'm going to push myself farther than you can.
Mm.
So that's where it began. Like, it began actually, one of my first interviewees was this ultra runner called Charlie Engel. And it's weird, like, there are loads of memoirs written by ultra runners, which talks about their history of drug addiction. And then they found running. It's like one of the mm-hmm. sports, which seems to attract people from a history of addiction. And so we were talking about how he finds that same sense of validation, telling people that he's going to run across the Sahara for 4 days, as he did when he was buying crack off dealers. And they were like, you're not going to smoke that much, are you? You know, it's the same sense of, yes, I am.
Yeah.
And there are all these other similarities, like, you know, it's a very kind of ruminative, meditative pursuit, as is drug taking sometimes. It can take you to a place of transcendence. So I thought that was a fascinating place to start. And from there, each chapter profiled people doing a very different pursuit. And I talked to them about why they got into it and why they can push themselves further than other people.
I love it. And what I love about it is one of the first questions I continually asked on this podcast to different people was, because I was seeing that, similar to you, is when I started boxing, I started doing a corporate boxing challenge. And I literally said in the first one, I talk about this a lot, I literally said to people, I'm the only person doing this to have fun. Like, everyone else has got these issues. I've got a drug addiction. I'm getting over a divorce. I was just like, fucking hell. What? I'm the only one that just wants attention. You know, like, I was so blind to the reality of what was about to be unearthed from the whole experience for me. But I'd seen that. And one of the other questions, and I'd kind of observed the type of people that were coming in after, you know, when I joined a boxing gym and I started competing in the amateurs. And I saw that relationship with also, you know, people with addictions and then coming and finding this new addiction, this new space. But one of the questions I kept asking different people was, does anyone agree that anyone who's achieving something great in any area of their life are running from or driven by something equally negative? Like, is the size of the achievement almost a direct reflection of the size of the pain that lies beneath?
Especially, I reckon.
And it's highlighted so much in combat sports, because we do get punched in the face. And I remember saying to one of my best mates, thinking, like, she was training and fighting in the Vic titles and then the Australian titles. And it was funny because I just think, in women's boxing, no one aside from us in the tiny little boxing community, no one knows. No one gives a toss. It's meaningless whether she wins or loses. The people that actually mean anything to her will love her anyway. but to us it holds something. And I was like, what is driving us?
Yeah, for me it was really interesting because I thought, I think it's shame that's driving me, because in a way I thought, you're just putting yourself in shame's way again. Like, you're basically putting yourself in a ring aged, when I had my amateur fight, I was 46, in your underwear practically, in front of a jeering crowd. Well, not jeering, but they're quite boozed up by that point.
Yeah.
Ready to get your face punched in and possibly publicly humiliated. What the hell's going on? And it really is like testing your mettle. It's like people who've been hurt perhaps in the past, especially as kids, I think keep having this compulsion to test, am I strong enough now to withstand stuff?
Yeah.
So pretty much everyone I interviewed for the book was pressure testing themselves, like, can I withstand stuff? Can I withstand stuff? And certainly people I've met doing Muay Thai, you know, often they've got a background of, like, they grew up within family violence, they grew up with sexual abuse, they grew up with some kind of, or bullying or something.
Mm.
And, you know, you do get people who just were started in martial arts by their parents as kids, and they're just naturally good at it and they carried on. But if you put them aside, pretty much everyone's got something to prove to themselves, you know?
Yeah. Oh, I'm fascinated by it. God, I've got 1,000 questions and more. tell me what other people and, I guess, experiences that they were going through that were different but similar.
People in the book?
Yes, yes.
Yeah, so...
Another well-formed question. I'm on fire, Jenny, I'm on fire.
It's quite early, isn't it? Well, I interviewed a performance artist, Stelak, who's done gruesome things with his body. You know, he's done a lot of flesh expansion. He's done a lot of surgery on his body. He's got like an ear implanted on his forearm.
What?
He's had the shape of an ear grafted on his forearm. And the idea was he was going to rig it up with a mic and whisper things into it. And then people could listen to what he was saying on the internet. And they could,
my God.
Yeah, sort of have a conversation. But it went completely septic, so that aspect of it didn't work. But he's done all sorts of really full-on things. And he was interesting because he agreed to meet me, and he says, look, I have to warn you up front, I'm the least tortured person you're ever going to meet. And he did buck the trend of everyone in the book. He has this purely has this artist's eye on what he's doing, unless he's covering up, you know, because he was insistent that there's no sense of being tormented or having any trauma in his life. But yeah, he was completely different to pretty much everyone else. Everyone else was either very naturally agitated and restless.
Yeah.
Like, I call the people in the book natural born leg jigglers. You know, they're just like, or they had some really painful stuff happen in childhood that they're using as fuel, trauma as fuel, really, or both. So yeah. I've also got like a bare knuckle boxer, Christine Ferreira, who's like top of her game. She fights for Bare Knuckle FC. And she'd been in and out of prison and, you know, was a street brawler, but then found the Muay Thai class in prison and got her ass kicked and was like, oh, okay, if you try and harness your rage and actually do fight properly, it requires a lot of discipline and getting your ego in control. Another thing that came up a lot was ego. Like, most people I've spoken to, myself included, had really big, fragile egos because they'd felt so vulnerable at some point in their life that they'd had to construct this kind of bravado and this ego, but it's very easily shattered.
Yeah.
So I mean, I wrote a little bit about learning to fight myself and the challenges of battling your own ego when you've deliberately chosen a career like journalism where you call the shots and you don't have to take instruction from people and you come up with your own ideas. So then to go into a gym and be ordered around and like spoken down to at times and humiliated and sparring is like mind-blowing.
Yeah.
And then there are people like there's a deathmatch wrestler who's, so deathmatch is when you use props and weapons and things. It is choreographed, but at the same time, it's genuine maiming of each other.
Yeah.
But if he, so he got injured at one point. His name's Crackerjack, the mad bastard. And he got badly injured, like he got a brain injury by being hit over the head repeatedly with a DVD player, which he provided. Yeah. But he didn't test it beforehand. It was more solid than he realised. And so he got this brain injury that like completely threw him off balance for years. He, you know, it was like he had to have the sort of rehabilitation a stroke victim would have to have, you know. But so that meant he couldn't wrestle in this period. And like it was a period of extreme agitation. Like where do you put that energy, which you would have previously been storming around a ring, shouting at your opponents and everyone's looking at you. And, you know, you're like, someone's hitting you with a baseball bat with a cactus strapped to it and you're bleeding everywhere.
Fuck.
What do you do when you can't do that?
What a shame.
Yeah, I know. But yeah, I mean, some people need those kind of crazy outlets. And if you can't have that anymore, this is another thing the book looks at. If you are suddenly plunged into retirement through injury or whatever it is, or the pandemic comes along and there's no matches anymore, how the hell do you cope? So basically it was using these really extreme people to extract lessons for us mere mortals on how to survive life.
Tell me what you extracted. Tell me what, like, with what you've learned, does it make you view how we're getting around as humans and coping with our lives differently? Like, do you think things have got to change and we've got to educate ourselves? Like what I hear and what I'm thinking when I'm hearing the stories and with what I know about myself and is, you know, my shit came up when I was in the boxing, you know, I'd boxed for a couple of years and I'd pushed myself always. I was busy doing, and then I hit my 30s and then getting a bit physically tired. Like it's exhausting. It's exhausting to do all the time and throw yourself in the boxing ring and keep yourself so busy. And then I would crash. But if I rested, this overwhelming sense of sadness and abandonment and loneliness, and I didn't even know what those feelings were. I just felt this. I would just cry, and I was like, I don't know why I'm crying. What is this feeling? Oh God, I'm too tired to get busy now. I felt my body needing rest that it hadn't had for 30 something years. That can't go on, right? So until our own eyes open to that, how do we fix it? And then when we start to learn, how do we fix everyone?
Yeah.
Or what have we learned from it?
I used to do the same as you. In fact, I still do, to be honest, where like each day I would be working out or you know, doing Muay Thai or doing whatever it is, weights, coasting on the increasing levels of chemicals, you know, this brace of chemicals. And then I would just go bang and hit a wall and crash and be like, what? What's going on? Why can't I stand up today? So yeah, I mean, people who are very all or nothing, recovery is maybe one of the hardest lessons to learn. Recovery and stopping and self-care and all that. I did learn about the last chapter. It looks at things like habits and goals and how, okay, some people are super goal-driven and there's no meaning to my life if I'm not striving for something.
Yeah.
And almost anything's got to be like, stuck on social media or people have to know I'm striving for it.
Right? Yeah.
I admit it. But that's kind of what happens is, say you're preparing for a race or a fight or whatever it is, doesn't have to be sport related. You put everything into that and then it happens and then you're bereft. Like you might even have some kind of identity crisis for like, who am I now? And you're like, shit, casting around for the next thing. So you're on this constant hamster wheel of striving for a goal. So what I learned was it's important to also have activities that you do just for enjoyment's sake, which sounds really obvious, but there was literally nothing in my life that I did just for enjoyment's sake. And so there are some sort of modern day philosophers who are drawing on what the ancient Greek philosophers were talking about, which is they've talked about telic activities, which are goals. So a telic activity could be you're training for a big fight, or you're putting a book out, or you want to create a podcast. you know, there's an end point, there's something you need to achieve or you fail.
Mm.
And then there's atelic activities, which are things that you do with no end point, you just do them without fanfare. So it could be like, you know, cooking, walking, whatever it is. And you've got to have that as well, because otherwise you'll just be having one identity crisis after another as you keep making it and achieving goals and then casting around for the next one. Like, again, to look at ultra runners, because they're quite extreme. You know, I interviewed one called Luke Tybersky, who would create his own ultra races and triathlons because there weren't any hardcore enough that existed in his mind. So, he would do them, and he'd spend the whole year. Oh, he would be like, oh gosh, swimming across the Gibraltar Strait, you know, like running up mountains and running through deserts. I can't remember the exact trails, but they were designed to cover absolute extremes of temperature and heights and lows and stuff. But he'd say, you know, like it would take a year to plan one of these things, which would be extremely enjoyable and very selfish. And then it would happen and he'd be so depressed. Like, he'd get into binge eating. He'd be like binge eating in the middle of the night. And then the next day he'd just like do hours and hours down the gym on the treadmill to try and like burn it off again. And he would just be lost until he started booking and creating the next race. So he was on this, again, this treadmill of pursuit and needs, you know? And I, you know, so I had an amateur fight mission while I was writing my book. I had this parallel mission of see if you can have an amateur fight by the end of it. And I did, like literally the week I handed in the manuscript. As soon as I had the fight, which I've been training for 2.5 years, my interest just went off like a switch. Like, I was like, done that. And I was thinking, no, come on. Like, all that training that you really enjoyed, just carry it on. And I have, but really it's not been the same, like, because I've just done the thing I set out to do.
Yeah.
And I'm wired to just go, right, next, next, next. So I guess it depends whether you think that that's a problem or not, but I think it can become exhausting, as you say, you know?
Yeah. I think what I see as can be problematic is, or what I experience, is this idea around there is a set of actions that I am now conditioned to for the neurochemistry, for the environment that it puts me in. So I questioned for a long time before I really got it, why did I have this pull? Because I was a next shiny object thing floating around. I'll do this, I'll do that. My boss's wife would be like, she'd see me at work, go, oh, what are we doing this week? You know, it's Bikram yoga 1 week, it's running the next, it's
jealous, funny,
you know, like ridiculous. Yeah. And I started boxing and I wasn't naturally good at it. I was also someone that was, if I'm not naturally good at it, I won't do it. So I did this challenge and I definitely wasn't natural at it, but I kept going back and it was always uncomfortable and it was always hard and it was always fraught with all the big, you know, hard feelings. But I kept going back and I was like, what is going on here? So there was this pull within my system. So I always look at that. And now I take those what I've learned from inside the ring to outside the environment and go, what is going on? So that when we had the pandemic and I pivoted and I made this podcast and it was amazing and I was smashing it out and I was like, that's okay, but we've just learned a lot about our coping mechanism. Is this real or is it a coping mechanism? Is this real or is it a coping mechanism? Are you really okay or do you just thrive in chaos and hard times? Like, does adversity just fill your cup? And you know, in this instance everything stayed consistent and I did do well, but I do see times when I am driven by the conditioning of situations. I'm pulled into certain types of relationships or experiences and you don't know until you come out and you look back and you go, oh fuck, I haven't you know, like, oh, I haven't fixed enough of what I thought I need to. I'm still dragging into this bullshit of whatever life circumstances has left me with coping mechanisms around.
Yeah, I just think I think we can strive for perfection and being well, maybe a bit too futilely though. Like, Okay, yeah. So going to the gym and wailing on a bag can be a coping mechanism, but so what?
It's bloody good.
Yeah, I mean, if I think of the people in the book, a lot of them previously had a really generally accepted unhealthy behavior pattern. Often it was addiction. And okay, now they throw themselves into a sport which might have long-term damaging effects on the body. It's still, in my mind, way more productive and way more enjoyable. And, they're getting recognition and pride from doing something well. I don't know about you, though. So one thing that martial arts and boxing and combat sports have to offer as well is, perhaps especially for women, that you're given permission to be really competitive and really, well, competitive, yeah. And that's something that often we've dampened down because it's not really socially acceptable. And I found that really liberating. Like, I was a really competitive child, and then I squashed that in my teens until now, really. And then it's like, okay, this is a healthier way to be competitive. You're actually in a ring, there are rules. If you're not an arsehole, you'll follow the rules. And you're squaring off with someone, it's so intense, just you and them. And you can just read deep into their eyes how they're faring in this round, and you either like inflate with power or you're on the back foot, and it's just so intense. And I have to feel that's healthy in some way. And often with combat sports, you'll get the big hug and the gratitude, the flood of gratitude at the end. And it's like, yes, because you've both allowed yourselves to feel these real primal things that we're supposed to feel as human beings, but we don't really get the opportunity to in the sort of lives we fashion for ourselves. So I think it's an amazing outlet in that sense, like sanctioned aggression.
And I love the aspect of it that is, for me, it was that metaphor of watching without, like, I couldn't put a mask on in there. I often talk about how the mask, the 29-year-old mask, fell off for the first time, and I was like, oh, look who's underneath. Like, you respond before you can make up a story in your head and make up a response. You've already responded, so you learn really quick. It's almost like I watch myself and go, oh, you say, like, Tiff that hops in a ring now and spars or even competes, like in 2019 when I competed, was very different to Tiff back then. Tiff back then, you could have just walked into any punch, couldn't give a shit, like, hit me all you want, can't even feel it. Then I did a lot of therapy, and then I hopped back and I sparred again, I fought again in 2019, and all of a sudden there was this, hey, I don't want to get hit. There's a bit of self-love. There's a bit of self-care. I'm not just going to walk into anything unnecessarily. I've proved that I'm tough, but this is, I'm not just going to keep beating my head against a wall. And that was, to me, like, when I did the therapy, I knew I would change as a boxer because I knew my biggest asset was disassociation from emotions and what was happening. So when I went and played with that for life, I was like, you know that if you're going to want a bit do boxing and actually, like, you're gonna change those mechanisms. You're gonna change your toolbox completely. It's fascinating.
Do you reckon you've retained that skill of, if someone's trying to press your buttons now, just as if they were trying to like punch you in the ring, do you think you've retained that skill of being able to put your emotions aside and like compartmentalize a bit?
I'm better at it, but it def like from the first time I stepped back in the ring in 2019, it had changed. I, for the first time, felt naked in there and didn't want to be there. I felt anxious and I re react. I was more reactive. There were times when I was sparring a guy that was southpaw and switching stance and really frustrating. And I remember once I was sparring him and I'd get close and I kept without, I didn't even know I was doing it, like, didn't choose to do it, but I would shove him and get annoyed. And I was like, oh, I never get annoyed or emotional. And like when I'm in there, despite being a fiery little explosive Taurus, when I'm in the ring, I can never get fired up or angry. It was just this technical poker face thing. And that was, to me, that was interesting because I was like, oh, sorry, John. Like, I was getting so frustrated and emotional that I was like shoving him and and I was like, that's not what we do.
Well, so I guess it needs maintenance like most things then. So we have to keep up that you can't just, I was hoping that I would coast on that feeling of invincibility that I felt after my amateur fight, despite losing, by the way. But the feeling of, well, I actually got in the ring in front of the crowd and did three rounds, and that's what I set out to do, and I feel fucking amazing. I hoped that would just like stick with me for life, but it only took like a few months later, hearing that this woman who ran the gym I was training at was saying she's got no talent, no talent, you know, that kind of stuff, for me to just crumble inside and think, well, I'm terrible at this, I shouldn't be doing it. And just remembering my training sessions and into clubs and, you know, the amateur in a more negative light. So it's incredible. That shows how fragile our sort of egos and, you know, how fragile they can be and how vulnerable we are. Like, we're putting on this armor. So it does show that you need maintenance. Like, you need to be, I am still training, but you need to be constantly like trying to stay in the same positive mindset. You can't just coast on something and think, yeah, nailed that. It's got to be like maintenance for life, isn't it?
I remember, you remind me, I remember there was one, my coach got a girl to come in and spar at our gym with me. I was mostly sparring with boys and one girl. We didn't have many girls there. Brought a girl in and we did a few rounds and I had to leave straight away. So, and it was a blood, but like her nose, she was a bleeder anyway. So, you know, totally wasn't me, but her nose bled from the first round. And what, like, we were both, it was, it, her face was just like a horror film. There was blood everywhere. It was quite revolting. And so we've had this massive few rounds and then I had to jump in the shower and get, leave straight away for work. And I just remember, when I spar, it was one thing, but when I performed, I was getting this, like, my control and everything was changing and I was doing things I didn't normally do and I would get quite gassed and I would get quite frustrated, you know, like, it was so frustrating. And from that first round, I was already self-critical. I was already like, fuck, why am I doing this? So I get in the car and I get to where I've got to go and I message my coach and I'm like, why does it happen? Why do I do that? Like, I was rare. And he wrote back a couple of times and then he's like, you literally wiped the floor with that girl and all you're doing is criticizing yourself. What is wrong with you? And because he doesn't give, he's not one to give compliments. And I was like, oh, because in my mind, I was shit ass.
Yeah. I've got to find you this little, just a snippet of a poem which I put in the book because it sums it all up, what you just said. Okay, so it's by Les Murray. It's a poem called Performance. And it begins, I starred last night, I shone, I was footwork and firework in one. And then the end of the poem is, as usual, after any triumph, I was, of course, inconsolable. And it's that, at the time, you have this real high and then you just go, you just find fault, you know, if you're an overthinker or whatever you just rip yourself to shreds. And I should be proud of what I've achieved, and certainly you should too, but there's this tendency to self-doubt. Like, if you give it the slightest chink in your arm, it'll just rip it apart, you know?
Yes.
100%. And then, so that means you've got to keep doing another mission to prove it to yourself.
Yeah.
Be strong again. I can be strong again.
Yeah. What was the catalyst for you? What was in your, if you share as little or as much as you like, but what was your kind of the driver in your background, in your upbringing? Like, what pushed you into, whether, did you say that you had an issue with addiction?
Yeah, I did.
Yeah.
I got really heavily into first drinking, like at 13, and then really quickly as many different drugs as I could.
Yeah.
And I quit at 34, and I do drink now, but I quit for 8 years, which was a good time to reset. And now it's all kept in check by my love of training and sport.
Yeah.
Quite naturally.
Yeah.
But there was, when I was a kid as well, I was sexually abused. So it's a really common pathway to then get into addiction. And it also seems like a common pathway to get into sport as well, to be honest with you.
Yeah.
and I took up kickboxing at the point where I was making a police report.
Wow.
So this is like, I don't know, 3 years ago. Yeah. I thought, this is going to be a situation that's out of my control. I'm finally tackling this thing from the past. I need something that's going to make me feel strong. Like, I'm hoping that if my body feels strong, that translates to the mind. And I needed some kind of form of anger management as well. And I thought, well, you know, taking it out on a bag or a person. Great. So so that was what was behind my training. Mm. And I think it's behind a lot of people's training, something similar to that, as you discovered too.
Yeah.
When you were training people you were talking to. But then the problem is, like, you're training specifically to feel stronger. And as you know, if you're training in combat sports, martial arts, you're constantly going to get your ass handed to you and feel so small and so vulnerable. So you'll get these moments of triumph and then boof, and then triumph and then boof. So in a way, I don't know if it's the best thing to do, but so many people choose it as a path. I guess it teaches you humility slowly, and the realization that it's not to become stronger. It's almost like the whole pattern of weightlifting where you've got to break the muscle and then make the muscle weaker and then it re-knits stronger.
Yes.
You've kind of got to do that of yourself.
Yes.
And I think training for a sport does that to you.
Oh, 100%. I wonder about I feel like I had the question well formed. Don't even know if it's a question. Don't even know. This idea around that experience in there for us, you know, part of it is that recognition of a time, you know, like how I said, I stepped into the ring and I would walk away with it, especially those first couple of years. I would walk away and often drive home from training and think, it's so interesting that this thing is my biggest passion, yet 95% of the time I feel unworthy, not good enough, worst person in the gym, frustrated, getting belted up. Like, there's probably 5, and that's being generous, maybe 1% of the time I'll have a time where I feel good. I've leveled up. I've walked away from a sparring session and gone, that's awesome. And I'm like, isn't that interesting? And now I look at that and go, is it the familiarity of feeling not an, is the fam, was it always just the familiarity of not feeling good enough felt like home? So to be there not feeling good enough 90% of the time was just so familiar that it was a good thing.
Yeah, I think you're right. And I think it's that idea of, and this is the ultimate test as well.
Yeah.
Like literally putting your body on the line. But there's also a sense of, okay, you might think that I'm the worst person in the gym, but you also pick up that there's a whole legacy here and everyone who's come before you has felt the same thing.
Yes.
So that's really powerful. Like literally the person who you will be fighting in the ring or everyone training alongside you has felt terrible after a sparring session and like they're a piece of shit and humiliated. Why am I doing this? Why the hell am I here? Like, everyone's felt that. So that's quite a powerful feeling.
Yeah. I always talk about this duality that I experienced of that was always there and loud, but also weirdly, especially in those first few fights, was this sense of knowing that I'm definitely winning this. There was no doubt in my mind that I had what it takes. It was just like this little secret that I was holding inside me that people don't know. People don't know, but there's no other way but winning this. And it was weird because I don't think at the time I was aware of the two. But then upon talking about it later, I was like, yeah, I always was embarrassed. I was embarrassed for my performance. I was embarrassed by what people thought I was shit and that I was probably wasn't good enough to be there. But also I would walk along, you know, visualizing my sparring thinking there's just fucking no one that can, there's no way that I can't, you know, not do this.
Yeah.
And how
it's such a weird dichotomy, isn't it?
Yeah. I don't know about you, but when I stepped into the ring with that background, I looked at the metaphor of boxing, this metaphor of the boxing ring, and I wanted to unpack what was connecting. And for me, things like standing in front of an opponent, standing in front of a predator, and the predator was not lying. The predator wasn't saying, I'm your friend. The predator wasn't saying to the crowd, we're in this together. They were like, hey, you Tiff and all you people watching, I'm going to hurt her. And I was like, the beauty of that honesty compared to childhood was, I think, was an attraction. And it resonated with me that there were all these people around that could care but couldn't help and wouldn't help. Like, it was like, you're all outside the ropes and no one but me can fix this. And it was those little things that I just, when I joined the dots, I'm like, no wonder. No wonder when I stepped in there, there was a home, there was a familiarity about it.
Yeah, yeah. It's quite funny as well, because at the interclub level, like I did for like friendlies first, the ref, he's in there with you, of course, will step in and help if need be. Like, yeah. So there is that safety blanket, and he's going, well done, good job, girls. Good job by both, good job by both. And then, of course, that's the last time you're ever going to get that.
Yeah.
As soon as you step up to the next level, yeah, it's basically you and this other person, and it feels like to the death.
Yeah.
Potentially it could be, you know, something goes horribly wrong.
Yeah.
But it's so exhilarating, isn't it? It goes so fast, and this feeling of power at the last minute as you step through the ropes, like, I'm doing this, there's absolutely no backing out now, is quite intoxicating.
Yeah. And I think it for me, it's one of the very, and I was just about to say maybe the only, but I think that when I get deep in editing podcasts is probably the only other thing I've done in the world that can take me fully out of a running commentary in my head and into a place where there's no other thought. So I recognise when I first started that boxing, I'd rock up at the gym after a day at work and I might be all pent up about something, and it was like I would know, like, I feel whatever I feel, and this is either going to break me or make me. I'm either going to finish this class and feel amazing, or by the time we cool down and everyone's on the ground doing abs, I'm going to skulk off to the bathroom and cry hysterically in the corner. It was like, you know, but it would wipe the canvas clean for my day. The thought, whatever was bad before, I couldn't even remember. Everything else that, you know, I couldn't escape my mind. My mind would be working no matter what else. I could multitask and do a thousand things, but you couldn't escape your thoughts.
Yeah. And also when we're adults, like, we tend to do things for hobbies or our career that we're really naturally good at and have natural flair at. And so to do something where you're not naturally good at it, as you said you weren't, and I wasn't either, it was just hard graft, is really full on. Like, especially being a journalist, it's, in my mind, it's trying to control the world around you. Like, you get to present a story to the public in the way that you've chosen to tell it. You've chosen these people to interview. You've chosen these quotes. It's all control. And then, you know, as soon as you get into a boxing gym, you've no control really.
Yeah, you can control one thing, and that's how you respond to all
the things. Yeah, barely, to be honest.
Yeah, yeah, well, true. In those first fights, I'll toddle back, you know, between each round, I'll toddle back to the corner and I'll be like, what happened? Like, I wasn't even, you know, like, what, literally, what happened?
Like, is that good? Did I win?
Yeah, I didn't even know. I didn't know if I'd win, lose, like, at all, like, couldn't feel anything, had no awareness. I'd watch the fights back afterwards and be like, oh, wow, I have, like, slipped that punch and come up and landed one. Like, I didn't know what was going on in there. I was just doing the thing.
In the moment, yeah.
Yeah. It's amazing.
It's really, I can't get over, like, professional athletes who can super compartmentalize their life. On the one hand, I'm really impressed, you know, like, they can just totally focus on something. On the other hand, it almost invariably means, not invariably, but often it means they'll create these crazy double lives because they can compartmentalize so well. Like, you know, you've got athletes who've got, like, you know, sort of separate drug issues or another family on the side, like, because that ability to compartmentalize and super focus that you've been trained to do or that you're naturally good at can be used in a more sort of negative, dark way as well.
Yeah.
I don't think I really have it too much. Like, I found it hard to shake off my self-consciousness in the ring when sparring, or my anger or my mood, you know.
Yeah, I feel very all or nothing, like there's no, yeah, how I am in one place, which I loved, right? Because that, like, the boxing ring for me became my little project place where I get to play with, like, the little, you know, make-believe model of what is Tiff and who is Tiff and all that, and I could see it there, and then I'm like, I would drive away from training and all the pennies would be dropping, like, oh, I saw that here, and I saw that here too. I saw that here. And then I learned to be able to do that in other areas of life.
Oh, that's
like,
good.
We start, when we're in the pandemic, I started sketching, I picked up a pencil and paper and I drew a picture of me and my dog from a photo, and it took really good shape, and I was like, wow. And as it was getting better and better, and the closer I got to finishing it, the more my mind was naturally, I noticed, going, what next, don't keep doing it, you'll fuck it up, and then people will realize you're not good at that. And I was like, ooh, this is not just this picture, this is what I do. I do something, I get accolades because it's working, I feel confident, and then because I don't trust myself, I move on before I can fuck it up or lose it, or before anyone can notice that I'm actually shit.
Totally. Like, if you just start out strong and show promising kind of progress quite early, then it is tempting to go, right, I'll quit on a high, I think.
So true. Did you say you're writing another book now?
Yeah. So the plan is... because it's very early days, but the plan is the book will be on fitness over 40 for women, so fitness and sport. So again, like, it will have really interesting people to talk to, like people to follow, and it will draw you into their outlier stories. Oh. But, you know, there's tons in it I want to cover that I'm yet to face, but I will eventually, like things like menopause or training with injury, or training after serious illness. And so all that stuff will get covered in it, but I really want to make it entertaining and compelling as well. So it's going to be very reliant on these larger than life characters too.
Oh, amazing. I've got some introductions to make for you. Have you heard of Lisa Tarmady?
No.
Oh, she is your jam, mate. She's an ultra endurance runner. She's in New Zealand. She has been on my podcast twice. Incredible story with her mother had a brain aneurysm and she fought the medical system and brought, like, incredible story. She ran the Libyan desert with four people. Like, they had to break into it because it was illegal to be there, and she had nowhere near enough. Like, just an amazing story. But she's 52. She's into biohacking as well. 52,
yeah,
super fit, really great. And yeah, I'm gonna reach out with a couple of people I reckon you'll adore speaking to on that topic. How can my listeners get, like, how do they buy your book? How do they get a hold of any of the content that you're putting out there?
Look, I mostly keep everything on social media, on Instagram. Can't be asked with the other platforms, really. So so I do things like readings from the book on Instagram and general video chat and bits and bobs. So that's JennyValentish_public. Trust me, the private one's not very exciting. So just follow the public. With the book, Everything Harder Than Everyone Else, you just Google it and it'll take you to loads of online stores like Booktopia, Amazon, whatever, really. Mm-hmm. And the same with Women of Substances. Just Google it and it'll come up. Booktopia usually has 20% off. You want to go there?
Awesome. Well, as I expected, I loved it. I feel like I railroaded a lot of your airtime here, but I just got too excited to talk to.
Oh, that's great. It's what you want. It's good to talk about the common experiences we've had.
Yeah. I love it. Thank you so much for being on the show.
Thanks heaps. Really appreciate it.
Thanks for tuning in to Roll With The Punches with me, your host, Tiffany Cook. Don't forget to subscribe, and if you're an Apple Podcast user, drop us a rating and review. Because if I know what content is landing best with you, then I'll make sure I keep hitting the mark. to stay up to date with all of my movements, upcoming events, training and mentoring programs, or to book me to speak at your event, then head over to my website at www.rollwiththepunches.com.au and be sure to connect with me on all the usual social platforms. Thanks for joining us.